Welcome to the Atom Ventures podcast. My name is Bhairav Patel. I'm the managing director of Atom Ventures and Atom CTO. And today I'm here with Mariska Dunlop from Life Armor. Say hello, Mariska.
Hi, nice to meet you.
So today's quite exciting. So I don't usually interview so many people that have built their own products, essentially. And really what I'd like to do is talk to you about your journey becoming an entrepreneur, obviously leaving the corporate world, but also building the brand and building a supplement business, essentially, because there's so many things that I find fascinating around that whole topic. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about your background. So you worked at Johnson & Johnson and Glaxo, Smithline Body Shop. Now, what made you decide to leave a well-paying job and have sleepless nights as an entrepreneur?
Yeah, that's a really good question, but no one tells you that it's quite like that either. So it was a bit of a natural transition for me, in all honesty. I did have a bit of a gut feel for quite a few years at the end of my corporate career that I wanted to do something else, and I wasn't sure what that something else was. And the transition was natural in that I was on maternity leave with my second daughter and my role moved. So I was commuting 15 minutes to work and my role moved sort of way over an hour commute. And it just meant very long days, 7 till 7 out of the house. So I actually started consulting and freelancing, and I did that for about 18 months. And it was through working on one of those projects. I was working on a menopause project for a client that I found myself immersed in the world of supplements, and I saw an opportunity for something different. And because I'm from a product and marketing background, I had this crazy idea that I'll launch my own brand. I can do this.
So what was the gap that you saw? So what was different?
So what was different was, I think I was really surprised. There was a few different things. So the biggest aspect was everyone, this is pre-COVID times as well. So just bear that in mind. So everyone was talking about the stress epidemic we're all living in. And everyone talked about how stress impacted our mental health, but no one really talked about how it affected us physically and emotionally. I had always been a working mum. And so a lot of my peer group were working parents, juggling many, many things. But outside of working parents as well, there were many friends that I had, you know, worked through my corporate career with that had gone to do different things. And I could see the impact that modern life and working life has on all of us. And this was something that resonated with a lot of my friends that I spoke to. And then when I looked to the supplement category to support my own well-being, first of all, I was really surprised that quality wasn't always a given. Coming from a skincare background, I thought that something you would ingest would quality would be the first and foremost. So that was point one. Secondly, when I went into a health, like a well-being store, I just found it, if I'm really honest, like so confusing. I couldn't say the ingredients that were on the front of the pack, let alone know what those ingredients did. And I thought, gosh, we could do better here. And then there is an aspect of my background was spent in skincare. And so I brought my sort of skincare thinking into the supplement space. So first and foremost, it was about having high quality and effective products. So free from fillers, alcohol, bulking agents, talk in a very simple language. So our products do what they say on the tin, essentially, within the realms of what you're allowed to sort of say in the supplement space. So drops of balance, recharge focus, for example, they do what they say. And then the look and feel of the brand is much more around a skincare look and feel. And the reason for that was because lots of people said, you know, I don't remember to take my supplements. But if they look nice, you don't mind having them on your kitchen counter or on your in your bathroom cabinet along with your skincare products. So yeah, so that's how it all sort of started.
So I think that's really interesting, actually, because I think you've picked out three areas. So you've got high quality, effective product and simple language. Three areas that make it very clear what you stand for, right? And yeah. I think that's something that I find that interesting simply because it is a very clear and measurable goals that you're trying to achieve, right? And a lot of times when people are starting businesses, they go, I want to get into an area, but they don't necessarily have those, that clarity of thought. Now, is that something that was brought in? Is that your corporate experience talking there? Or is that just something that, you know, how did you kind of make it so clear as to those three things?
That's a really great question, actually. I think there is a lot of it is about my corporate background. So I spent 18 years working in FMCG marketing. And whilst it was not in the supplement space, I was developing innovation and marketing for other businesses. So I think the clarity for me came very quickly, but it came through analyzing the market and then being clear what I could see from looking at the competition in the marketplace. Actually talking to consumers as well was really important to get that insight. So, you know, there is an aspect of going with your gut feel, and everyone's going to have an opinion, but it is also incredibly important to get opinions of others and then take a measured judgment of those. You know, I don't think, you know, so if you think of something really innovative like the iPad, I'm not sure if any consumer would have said, yes, I need that in my life. Absolutely. But then if you're going into categories that already exist, it's important to just get a feel for customers about what their pain points are. And then it gives you the clarity of how you can help them overcome those.
So how long was the journey in the making? Because obviously, well, I'm assuming that you didn't really just one day stop everything and decide to go and do this. But you, as you mentioned, you've analysed the market, you talked to customers. So what was that process like? How long was that?
So the process for me to launch Life Armor was a relatively quick one, if I'm really honest. There was, I'd spent a number of months beforehand, like I said, sort of consulting for other businesses, looking at the market. And I had various ideas to begin with. So I was looking at different areas of the supplement space. So lots of people will know that well-being is a huge category and is growing exponentially. But it came down to as well, where were my core skills? So an example I had was launching an e-com platform, and that had different ideas behind it. But the reality was I'm not by any means a technical expert or an e-com expert. My expertise is in creating product. But I treated it as if I was in the corporate world. So I did literally sit and create a strategy deck where there was competitor research, you know, so that's literally Google, you know, looking at what are the brands out there? What do they offer? What do they claim? You know, what's their positioning in the market, their price points? So pulling all of that piece together, talking to consumers can be done in different ways. You know, I was fortunate enough to speak to ex-colleagues, friends that work in other parts of, you know, whether that be communications, strategy, all sorts of different parts of business. But I also did speak to my core target of women, and we tested product out with them before we launched as well. So yeah, that was really important for me. We developed product, but then tested it before launch, because it allowed us to have, I was very confident in the product anyway, because I was working with experts who had formulated it, but it gave us some testimonials for launch as well that really helped.
So focusing on the development of the product, obviously you didn't have a kind of a supplement background. So how did you come up with the different products within the brand?
So in two ways. So the whole proposition of Life Armor is about addressing the impact stress has on our health and well-being. So I looked at, you know, what that is, then therefore it's, you know, different pillars of the needs. I guess one is it impacts your sleep. That's a really big area. It impacts your energy, and it make, you know, there are feelings of stress and anxiety, and that, you know, people can feel that in terms of their cortisol peaking. So we had a very tight range of four products when we first launched, two capsules and two liquids. And it was really a case of just putting something out to market and testing what worked. And it's really funny. I assumed that one thing would be the key seller, and it was something completely different. So what I would say is that if you're fortunate enough, which I was, to work on low MOQs, I had a manufacturer that would work with me on very low MOQs. It gives you the ability to put product out there and test exactly what works, because your assumption is never going to be proven until you're out in market.
So if you could just let people know what MOQ is.
Sorry, yes. So your minimum order quantity. So it's what your manufacturer creates, basically produces for you.
So obviously quality was one of the things that's very important for you. So how did you go about finding your manufacturers?
Yeah, it's not easy at all. I was very fortunate in that I was given a recommendation. So I didn't go. So you can go to fairs and, you know, obviously not at the moment, but pre-COVID times, you could go to events where there'd be, you know, contract manufacturers there. There'd be different raw material suppliers. But I met at my manufacturer through a recommendation. And like I said, I was lucky because they were happy to work with me to begin with on some small quantities to test out, which was key. I know that sometimes it's one of the biggest barriers to launching because a manufacturer has quite high volumes that they want you to commit to. And that's a cash injection up front and a commitment from you as a business owner to put the cash behind that.
Was there a kind of element there that they believed in what you were trying to do and were looking to support that as well? Or was it just that they're open?
Both, actually. The manufacturer that I've worked with has got a long history of working with experts in the natural ingredients area. But they also felt that what I was doing was quite different. And our volumes have, you know, really have changed since the beginning, which has been great. And they've been able to, you know, work with me on that.
So let's talk about building the brand. Obviously, you have a marketing background, so you understand how to communicate with your customers. So what did you find the most challenging aspect of building the brand? I mean, I know for me, finding names is always quite hard for companies. But to be less flippant, what are the things that you found?
I think that there's a couple of things. The operational challenges of setting up a business and running a business are so time consuming. So you can have your great idea. You can have, you know, even the formula that you think is the right formulation, but just simple things like, getting the right packaging, the lead times on it, you know, and we did have challenges. So, that our liquids were actually launched in opaque glass bottles. And then we had a huge issue with labeling them in terms of just keeping the labels looking smooth and, you know, professionally finished, basically. And that was because there was imperfections in the glass. But you're doing so many different things. I don't think anyone would think, oh, there's imperfection in this type of glass bottle. What could our solution be? So operational challenges come from all different angles that you don't expect, and they can take quite a long time to resolve. And being a startup, your volumes are not the same as the bigger players as well. So again, you might have to commit to a minimum order quantity of a certain amount. So that took up a lot of time, and just you're constantly problem solving, to be honest. So that was quite difficult. And then I think when you're coming from a corporate background as well, what you're often used to, and I was particularly used to, is there was a finance department, there was a legal department. And that all, when you're a founder, comes down to you. You're fully responsible, and sometimes you need to rely on the expertise of others. So that, I think when you're in corporate, you have full, you know, the buck doesn't necessarily stop with you. You can lean on other departments, whether it be regulatory, legal. When you're a founder, everything falls to you at the end of the day, even if you have relied on someone else's expertise, and perhaps that hasn't been the correct expertise they've offered.
So I think where there's a significant difference between what you do and, say, let's say what we do in service industry, is that you've got so many more moving parts of what you're doing, right? As you mentioned, you've got the manufacturing, but you've got the bottling, the packaging, the delivery, making sure that the right ingredients are in in the right supplements. And then you've got the other part of actually trying to sell the thing. And running the e-commerce business and financing and accounting for all the sales and all that kind of stuff. So that, you know, it's huge. So did you have any support at the beginning?
Actually, so there's two things, I guess. So actually, Life Armor's journey began with my co-founder. So Life Armor's was sort of my conception, but a very, very close friend of mine, Alex, was part of that journey and had been battling breast cancer. And it was always sort of the focus that Life Armor gave, and we had lots of plans for the future. It gave her a really positive focus, and she was always supposed to be part of this. And unfortunately, a month after we launched, she sadly lost that battle, which was probably the biggest challenge to overcome at the time. I think we knew it was going to happen, in all honesty, but I think the power of positivity was something that we all focused on to just believe she was very young that would get us through. So she was you know, a big part of the journey and probably the biggest sort of source of encouragement. I would run so much past her. She would help where she could at times. But, like I said, you know, her focus was at the time sort of battling cancer. But that's still, when you're doing everything on your own, to have that, you know, partner there to share things with was incredibly useful. And, you know, it gave me the confidence to launch. I had some freelance support, but in all honesty, I did most of it and I still do most of it on my own. And you're absolutely right. It is an absolutely huge juggling act. But I also do recognize that there are areas I have expertise in and areas that I really don't. So like the digital landscape is not something at all that I have strong expertise in. And it's taken me a little bit of time. I've worked through various different freelancers and experts, but I'm currently really happy with the guy that I'm working with and feel that he's incredibly solid, honest, and is very thoughtful because it's a self-funded startup, so it's my money. But that's taken me a little bit of time to find that solution, you know, so there's been, you know, learning curves during that time.
No, I can imagine. And I think that it's one of those things, isn't it? When you're starting the business, you rely heavily on the people that can provide the expertise. So you rely heavily on your accountant to make sure that they're doing the right thing, and the lawyers to make sure that they've got the right agreements in place. And it's all, I think that in many ways, it's the hardest thing is managing them, because of course you don't necessarily have the expertise, but then you're relying on them so much. You need to make sure that what's being done is right, because obviously those are the things that can go horribly, horribly wrong. Right.
Yeah.
It can really impact your business early on, where the risk is the biggest. And then if something happens, then you go under pretty quickly, right? Money's not in the right place or the legals aren't right.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point, actually, because when I first started out, I met entrepreneurs in very, very different spaces. And I was always, this was, you know, it was a bit of my redundancy money and some savings that we decided to put into Life Armor, my husband and I. And, you know, we were both completely, you know, agreed on that. But I'd go and meet other people and they talked to me about how they were spending $100,000 to launch a website and establish a website without having made a penny. And I was just astonished, because there are platforms like Shopify that you can go out and prove your concept on. So what I would say is, be very measured. Unless you've got, you know, huge financial backing that's not your own cash, just think about how to spend your money, because it really is a test of concept to begin with. No matter how much pre-testing you do and whatever anyone tells you about a product, you know, until you get it out there to see if it sells, you know, that's the actual proof. So if you're, you know, spending, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands to begin with, that's quite, you know, that's quite a commitment.
No, definitely. And I think, you know, when people come to us with technology concerns and are looking to build something, we always try and tell people, do it all on paper first. So if you can do it on paper, I mean, obviously you can't sell, if you're selling online, then Shopify is great, or Magento, or whoever you want to use is great. But then if you're looking to build the back end operational piece, just do it on paper first, to then understand where your pain points lie. Because you may start building technology thinking you're solving one problem, but actually that's not the problem you need to solve. And there are other problems there that you'll find as you scale that become much more urgent.
Absolutely. I think, yeah, that's absolutely key, because yes, until you get it out there and test it. And like you say, if you're then scaling, you can see what the issues are.
So you say everything's self-funded. Have you not looked for investment, or has it just been a difficult thing to get investment for?
Yeah, I haven't looked for investment, to be honest. I think the business has been growing at such a pace that I'm so focused on just keeping up and actually driving the pace even harder with new products and new retail opportunities, that I'm not really taking much of a salary, in all honesty, but I am taking some salary and I'm just investing at this stage. And the reason I haven't looked for investment is because I've just been so focused on driving the business. And I think, you know, I haven't spent much time, you know, looking into it yet, but I do really believe from talking to other people that actually raising is a full-time job. And as the founder, yes, I'm absolutely prepared to do that, but equally, who's going to be running the business? And I haven't I haven't got that number two in place that I feel confident enough. And that, you know, that might happen over time, you know, absolutely. And I'm really open to it, but I'm in a fortunate situation, I guess, that I am taking some form of salary. It is not anywhere near what, you know, a corporate salary was. And I'm just reinvesting as much as possible back into the business right now.
Yeah. And I can definitely say that fundraising is a full-time job and it does distract a lot from what you're doing on a day-to-day basis. And ironically, you always need to start fundraising when you don't need the money, because it can take you so long to get it all through. But if you're in a situation where you don't necessarily need to raise funds, and that's even better if you can sustain that growth, that's fantastic. So I guess my question really there is, you said you haven't hired a number two, but obviously, you know, as you scale, you can't keep doing all the different things that you're doing. You know, how have you looked at recruitment? How have you looked at maybe building a team and kind of building a culture around life?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I did bring someone into the business. So on a personal level, we made a very big move out of London about 6 months ago. So I did bring someone into the business that had been freelancing for me. And unfortunately, it didn't work out. And it's, you know, when you've brought your first person in sort of full time and it hasn't quite turned out to what you were expecting it to be, that's, you know, it's disappointing. It ended up causing me more work and more stress when actually it was supposed to be helping me manage the business and also manage some personal, you know, personal life as well. So what I've done for now is instead of rushing into then recruiting someone else, I've just taken a step back and gone back to using a broader group of freelancers and just see where that takes me, because I could have been reactive and just gone straight back out there to try and recruit someone else. But this felt like the right thing for me at the moment. And the way that that's evolving with some of my freelancers, there may be someone that is very, very strong in the digital space and in advertising and in the analytical side that I might bring in a bit more. But at the moment, it's giving me the flexibility that I need.
So that's interesting, I think. So one thing I'd ask there, you don't have to go into huge amounts of details, but what did you learn from that experience? Because I've done podcasts before where we talk about hiring, and actually the first person you bring on is probably the most important and the hardest hire, simply because you're actually doubling your team. When you get to a situation and you've got 100 people and you're adding another 10, that's not as hard, actually. Whereas the first hire is very, very important. So what lessons have you learned?
That's a really good question. Perhaps the area that I brought them into wasn't necessarily the right first hire. But I think what I would do, I'd do it again. I would think I would bring someone in on a freelance or temp basis before ever employing them, which I did on that occasion as well. But the challenge was the work ethic was not what I needed it to be. And that was not at all I'm a really incredibly reasonable individual. So it wasn't expecting long hours. You know, that's not a culture that I would, want to encourage. But I think, you know, people have struggled perhaps working from home and remotely, and perhaps there was a lack of focus because of that. I do fully understand that a founder will always have a different level of energy and passion and enthusiasm versus anyone else. But I'm aware of that. So I'm not necessarily expecting that, but I'd be looking at someone that was excited to be in the business and, you know, with real drive. And I think you can only, with a view to obviously, measured growth as well. So always, if you're spending to grow, are you getting the return for that as well? So I think that's why I'm going more cautiously.
I guess the question there I have for you is, do you think that role that do you think the areas of your role that you were kind of carving off were the right ones, or was it just the wrong person for the role?
I don't think it was the right person in that role at the time, unfortunately. So, it was an area of focusing basically on social media advertising, social media. I mean, I think that the power of social media is phenomenal. It is to a certain degree. I now have freelancers that help me and they say, can you do this? Can you do that? Content creation takes time and I have to make choices. And at the moment I've got a big retailer asking me to do a number of different things for them. And I have to prioritize that over aspects for the social element. And also, you know, I haven't grown up in the social age, so it's not necessarily second nature to me. Whereas I've got a great freelancer who's come out of university and loves creating content. It's a real passion, and you can see that in the work that she produces. So I need to think, you know, more carefully about, to your point, I think it's a very fair one of maybe looking at what is the right number two to bring in. And I think that will be a hybrid over time, if I'm really honest with you. I think I would, I wouldn't bring someone in full time. I think it might be a hybrid of a few different things.
I think I can definitely sympathize on the social media digital aspect. I mean, obviously, obviously we, you know, podcasts here and these things are great. So obviously this is a great way to raise profile, but, it's also, it's such a, the amount of work that you have to do is huge. And when you are doing so many different things, it can be it's hard to dedicate the time to build the quality of content that you need, right? And I think that's the thing. You can't just push out any old thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're right. And I think, you know, the freelance team that I have helping now said, you know, we need to see more of you. And I understand that. And I think there's just, you know, it's the energy. Absolutely. And then once I do it again, it's, you know, it's absolutely fine. I don't, you know, and I do enjoy it. It's just, there's trade-offs, like you say, when you're doing so much.
So let's talk about women in business. Now, this is a topic I have no clue about because I'm not a woman in business. So, but it's something that people ask me about when I'm doing podcast interviews. And are you talking about women in business? And I say, yes, I do. Whenever I interview a female founder, I always ask about it. And I always kind of get similarly the same answer in that most people tell me that, or most female founders I meet tell me they haven't really thought about being a woman in business. They're just thinking about the business itself. So, you know, obviously, there's a lot of focus on diversity and inclusion and you know, investment in female entrepreneurs. Having grown this business over a few years, what have you seen? How's the market been for you?
Actually, that would have been my exact response to you. I don't see myself as a woman in business. I just see myself running a business. And I don't, you know, I know there's a lot written about the fact that female founders do not get the same level of funding that male founders do. But in all honesty, I don't have the headspace to absorb any of that, you know, with everything that's going on. So I'm like, okay, that's a fact. That's fine. But it's not a focus for me. So actually, I have found on the whole, the experience of being an entrepreneur and startup life incredibly collaborative in a lot of ways compared to perhaps the politics of the corporate world and, you know, the focus on just your profile and what the perception of you in a corporate environment. I've just been, you know, people just want you to succeed. They really do. And I think, you know, so like to your point, I don't see myself as a woman in business. I see myself just running a business, but it's when you talk to other people and you tell them then what you do and they're like, wow, you know, how do you go about doing that? So that's quite, you know, that's a nice piece of feedback to receive because, you know, when you're talking to other people, they're quite impressed, you know, that you've gone and set this up. And there are definitely a lot of people that want to support and encourage you and make the business a success. So I think one of the big turning points for Life Armor has been the fact that a year ago, Liz Earle, who is incredibly well regarded in the well-being space, started using our brand. And she is a huge supporter of British female founders, is what she talks about. And that's because she herself founded her own skincare business, you know, quite some time ago, and has gone on to sell that and then, you know, is now very much in publication and content creation. But she talks very openly about how hard it is for businesses to cut through and, you know, just someone being so well regarded, talking about your business very genuinely, that has been a real step change for us, to be honest. So I can only say that I've had positive experiences so far.
I think running a business is a great leveler, right? Becoming an entrepreneur, because it doesn't matter where you were, what job you had before in corporate world, what you were doing. Mm. Everyone starts at the same place, right? From zero sales. So you have to then go out and start doing things. And it doesn't matter what you were running in a division. As you said, you know, you don't know all the legals, the manufacturing.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I'm really honest, there are days, especially in the beginning, let's say with IT, I was like, I really, you know, I missed having that, you know, that expertise there. It's very different. I would say that there are many days that when you've gone from running a team and then having the reliance on expertise in other departments as well, and you're just making decisions on your own. You know, I think, you know, I've stopped running everything past my husband because he hasn't got the capacity for it, but he doesn't want to hear it either. You know, you've got to be more decisive and just have conviction in your, you know, in what you're doing.
I think one of the things I've learned anyway is that it all comes down to risk, right? So decisions you make, there are some decisions you're going to make that are risky, some that aren't. But as long as you understand the risks, you can figure it, you know, you can figure it out. Because as you say, you could go and for every single decision you make, you could ponder on it. Then there are some that you make where you think, okay, fine. If I do it, what's the worst that's going to happen? And then there are some that you could really do something, could impact the business quite massively. And so you then spend a bit more time thinking about it, right? And then pondering it. And I think that's the key. I think what you do is you learn to filter out what's important.
Absolutely. And also just try things out. You know, no one's got a crystal ball to tell you what is going to happen. So there's a couple of things, you know, coming up for us that I've debated over time and I've, you know, been very cautious about it. It may be the maker, it may not be, but until you try it, you don't know. I've been fortunate enough to make some good friends in this space. And one of them was saying, you know, everyone says, start in your local market. That's what you know. And she said, you know, actually, that was the worst piece of advice we were ever given, because actually for them, the focus is America. And I understand why they've gone to the US for the size of, you know, for the what they the product offer they have. The population need over there is much greater than it is here. And that's been the making of them. And until you, it's always a test and learn. And I think you're right. It's got to be calculated. So you've got to be prepared for things not to work. And it's the level of risk you want to put behind that. So if you want to test something out on, I don't know, Amazon, and you want to spend £10,000 to see if it works, okay. If you want to spend £100,000, are you prepared to lose that? Because it may not pay back. And you've just got to ask yourself those questions all the time.
100%. I think what you've pointed out there is that the thing on the local market is that you should always be wary of experts. I think that's the key. And I think one thing I've learned is that whenever you talk to an expert, you go back and say, what have you actually done? What have you built? And what have you succeeded in or even failed in? But,
Yeah. I think someone did say to me, I had a very good, she was, one of my old bosses actually, when I took her through the business plan in a lot of detail. So she was sort of headed up finance for one of the big corporates I worked for. And so I ran through to sense check a lot of the numbers with her. And she, you know, that was great. But, you know, she said to me at the time before we launched, you have to be prepared for this not to work. And I sort of sat there with a real sinking feeling, to be honest, because I thought, gosh, for me, this is an extension of me as a person. So actually the thought of that was really hard. I mean, she was absolutely right. It was very solid advice. Because these things might not work. And it's just being aware of that. I am fortunate that it's working incredibly well for us, but it's always, you know, it's always a roller coaster. There are always challenges that come up and you have to sort of navigate how you're going to manage those at the time.
Definitely. And I'd actually nuance that piece of advice and say, it may not work, but it may not work in the way you expect it to. Because I think the problem is, when you come up with your business plan, you think that's the plan that I'm going to execute. And if it goes wrong, that's it. But actually, that's not the truth. You can adjust.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the biggest skill I've probably learned in the last couple of years is hustling. If I'm really honest, we had a huge, huge operational challenge about 3 months ago now, that wiped out a lot of our componentry. It was, you know, just a massive issue. I found myself finding solutions through asking favors of people, finding stock and componentry in different places. And there is no other way to say it other than it honestly was hustling. It's like, we've got this crisis. How do we fix it? I can't go out of stock. We can't have our subscribers that want their product every month to not receive it. So we, you know, I had to come up with a plan of how we would address that. So, you never really hustle in the corporate world. It's just, there's too many processes in place that don't allow hustling. So
it's true. So what's the last question for you? So what's the future for Life Armor? Where are you going? Where are you going with the product, the supplements?
Yeah, we've got a couple of new supplements coming out in September. That are currently just in trial now. We're also talking to a number of different big retailers. And, you know, to your point earlier, you know, these conversations can take some time, and things that come to life can also take time. Our focus is very much still on direct to consumer. But obviously, as the world opens up, you know, retail does become a focus for us as well. So it's really about innovation and establishing some partnerships with some retailers.
And if people have liked what they heard, how do they get in contact with you? How do they find Life Armor?
So Life Armor is at www.lifearmor.co.uk, or follow us on Instagram at Life Armor Nutrition.
Excellent. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Mariska. Many thanks.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you like what you hear, then please subscribe. We're the Atom Ventures podcast, and you can find us on Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, all the great podcasting sites. Please also leave a review, and if you want to get in contact, then please visit our site, atomcto.com. You can find us on LinkedIn under Atom Ventures and Atom CTO, and you can email us at info@atomcto.com.